I love this chapter, We Agnostics. I said the other day, Gnostic means knowledge. You put the ag in front of it, means without. Those of us who are without knowledge. You know, Bill had the same problem with this God idea as we did. Remember in his story, he said, when they talked to me, God personal to me, he said, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such theories. He had that problem, and he knew that we were going to have that problem. Later on in our book, it said that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we would straighten out mentally and physically. When the spiritual malady is overcome, and this chapter here is an attempt to help me straighten out spiritually, because I'm like Charlie. I got here, I had the spiritual knowledge of a seven-year-old boy, which you can imagine what it was. Didn't have any other than that. So I needed some ideas, some new ideas. I had to give up some old ideas in order to accept some new ideas. And that's what this chapter is all about. You know, Dr. Jung said that ideas, emotions, and attitudes, the ones that I had since I was 7 years old, was the guiding force of my life. And I needed some new ideas, emotions, and attitudes returning regarding God. And this chapter gives me those ideas. And Father Bill Wilson, he's dead now, bless his heart, but he was an exceptional man. At the age of 15, he was took to the University of Rome, and he studied there for the next 30 years. And during those 30 years, he received 3 doctorates. And you know that he read a lot of spiritual material during those 30 years. And he told us, told me and Charlie, a long time ago, he said, this chapter, We Agnostic, is not here to tell me about a particular type of religion or a particular type of God. He said, this chapter here is written for one reason and one reason only, to allow me to think about this idea, what this idea of God means to me. And then to open up my mind, this chapter here is to help me open up my mind so that God might teach me that there's a God, a whole new concept in the way that I was able to look at things. And this chapter, We Agnostic, does exactly that. I just ask myself what these things mean to me. Just me. And my mind gets opened, and God begins to disclose himself to me slowly over a period of time.
Okay. We Agnostics. In the preceding chapter, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made it clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit drinking entirely.
That's because of the obsession.
Or when drinking, you have little control of the amount you take.
That's because of the allergy.
You are probably alcoholic. I like that. You're probably alcoholic. You've got 2 questions to determine if you're now. It don't take but 2. You know, we got some pamphlets now with 44, 20, and all them. It don't take but 2 to determine if you're an alcoholic. Real simple.
I'm real glad that when Ebby walked into Bill's kitchen, that he didn't have the 44 questions. He would have said, Bill, has your reputation been suffering from alcoholism? Well, he hadn't had a reputation in years. Then he would have said, Bill, has your sex life been suffering from alcoholism? If he's anything like I was, he hadn't had any of that in a long time either. He would have confused the hell out of Bill with 44 questions. We just need 2. I use them all the time. People come to me today and say, Charlie, you think I might be alcoholic? I say, I don't know. Let me ask you a couple questions. Have you been able to quit drinking entirely, left on your own resources? If they're a real alcoholic, they got to say no. And then I say, do you have any control over the amount you drink after you once start drinking? If they're a real alcoholic, they got to say no. And then I say, well, then you're probably an alcoholic. And it's really, really just that simple. Now, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. You know, we're very, very unique people. We number amongst a few people in the world who have a twofold illness, an illness of the body as well as an illness of the mind, that can only be overcome by a spiritual experience. We also number amongst a few people in the world who have a terminal illness, that we can come out of it in better shape than we went into it if we can have the spiritual experience. Now, to one who feels an atheist or an agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death,
Step one.
Or to live on a spiritual basis,
Step two.
Are not always easy alternatives to face. And we found it right here. We had to stop and take a look at what our ideas about God really are. Are we an atheist? Are we an agnostic? Or just what are we? And I found that we had to go back to the dictionary again and look these words up to see what they really mean in order to see where we stood in our relationship with God. Joe, what is an atheist?
An atheist is a person, is one that doesn't believe in God. He doesn't believe in God. He never makes a decision to use it. He never gets results from it. So he does not know, have any faith in God at all. He has no, he has no use for it. It doesn't work at all in his life because he does not believe in it.
In other words, if he doesn't believe there's such a thing as God,
that's right,
then he has no power greater than human power to turn to.
That's right.
So therefore, the atheist must stand on his own two feet, make his own decisions, run his own show, and rule his own destiny because he has no power greater than human power to turn to. I said, Charlie, are you an atheist? And I said, no, I'm not an atheist. I've always believed in some kind of God. So I said, well, if you're not an atheist, then maybe you're an agnostic. Joe, what is an agnostic?
Agnostic is someone who believes there's a God, but he has no personal knowledge of it, which was me. I rejected a long time. I had no knowledge of God. I rejected those ideas. I didn't believe that God existed, but I didn't have any knowledge of it or any experience with it, so I just denied that it existed too.
So an agnostic is one who believes in God, but since he's never turned to that God to get strength and power, he stood on his own two feet, run his own show, ruled his own destiny. He acted just exactly like the atheist acted, yet he believed in God at the same time, but he got no more help from God than the atheist got from God. I said, Charlie, are you an agnostic? And I said, you bet your boots I am, because I've always believed in God. I just never did turn to God except in those cases of real emergency. I ran my own show, made my own decisions, ruled my own destiny, just exactly like the atheist did, even though I believed in God.
There's only one other way you can believe about God, isn't there? If you're not an atheist or an agnostic, that only leaves the true believer.
Right.
And I look back in my life to the people that I thought were true believers. My mother was a true believer in God. She trusted God all of her life. She tried to instill that up in me, and I rejected it. But she lived that way and trusted God all of her life. So she was a true believer. And that's the only third way we can believe about God.
So the true believer is one that not only believes in God, but acts as if they do. Turns to God for help and direction, and lets God run the show, and they get God's power in their life.
They know.
So the question becomes then, whether we're atheist or agnostic, how do we get from that state to the state of being the true believer, one who can receive God's power in our lives? And the book said, but it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type, either atheist or agnostic. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. Perhaps it's going to be that way with you. But cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics, and our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. So I think what Bill is saying to us here is it really doesn't make any difference what you believe when you get here. You're still going to be able to become a true believer, providing we're willing to turn loose of some old ideas, accept some new ideas, and start taking some action based on those new ideas. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. You know, alcoholics are not drunken bums. Drunken bums are just about where they want to be. They're not too interested in changing the situation. We alcoholics are there with a drunken bum, but we don't want to be there. We have good codes of life. We have good philosophies. We have a set of morals. And if those morals and philosophies of life would have saved us, we would have recovered long, long before we came to AA. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. You know, that's the only reason we're in AA today. If our morals and our philosophies and our codes of life would have saved us, we would have never become members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is the court of last resort. We came here because we couldn't find the power to overcome our alcoholism in any other way. You know, I've never seen an alcoholic yet that said, I took a drink at age 14, jumped up and down, shouted with joy, and said, I can hardly wait to be a member of AA when I'm 38 years old. No, we came here because we had no place else to go. If we could have found the power otherwise, we certainly would not be in AA today. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. Now, it doesn't say which will enable you to solve your problem or will help you solve your problem. It says it will enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. And we find it interesting enough from page 45 on in the big book. We're through talking about alcohol. We talk about one thing and one thing only from this page on. For those of us who are powerless, how do you find the power? And if we can find the power, then the power will solve the problem. Now, if we're going to find the power, we're going to have to start somewhere to find that power. Joe?
Let's go to page 46, please. You know, to reemphasize what Charlie, I had a lot of morals. I had a philosophy of life prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. But because of my drinking and the things that I did while drinking, I compromised those morals and those philosophies, and then I couldn't even live up to those. You find yourself in a heck of a position if you don't have any principles to live by, and that's where I found myself. On page 46, first paragraph, said, yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let's make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice, which
remember,
is old...
Remember, prejudice is old ideas.
And express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. When I first come to Alcoholics Anonymous, before I come to AA, I was one Sunday morning, sincerely and honestly and humbly as I knew how, I'd had all I wanted to drink. And I got on my knees and I asked God that morning for help. And that's something I didn't do. I mean, since I'm 7 years old, I don't ask God for nothing. I don't ask another human being for nothing either. See, I was my master of my own fate. And but that morning, it looked like God wasn't going to help me. And about 2 hours later, I think I called George Gibbs, my little black friend there that we were friends, and asked him if he was still a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said that he was. I said, would you help me? See, there's two things I don't do. I don't ask God for help, and I don't ask another human being for help. So George came over to my house and stayed with me for the next 3 days, and finally took me to my first AA meeting. My first thought when I sat down in those tables and looked around, 3 days not drinking, something very profound happened. I looked around the room, and I said to myself, What's a nice guy like me doing in a place like this with people like you? I have made a mistake. I don't belong here. See, Sunday morning I was beaten, licked, totally. 3 days not drinking, that old ego, that old pride, that old self-reliant attitude began to come back. And I said, I don't belong here. And I began to start having trouble with this God idea, real trouble, because my knowledge was that of a seven-year-old boy. George recognized that one day. He said, Joe, you're having real trouble with this God idea. I didn't tell him about that Sunday morning. He wanted him to know that. And I said, yes, I am having a hard time with that. He said, well, Joe, I want to ask you to do something. Go home tonight, get you a pencil and a piece of paper. Realize that you can't make God. But if you could make God, what would you want it to be? So I went home that night and I wrote down some things that I would like God to be. And I showed those to George, and he looked at them, and we talked about them a little bit, and he said, that's good. You can start there. See, that's one of my problems. I needed a starting place. Mm-hmm. You know, years ago, I went to a preacher trying to get back home with one of my wives, and he told me that I must, and boy, did he emphasize that word. You must have faith in these things. And he told me what they were. I could not have faith in those things. You know why? Because I didn't even believe them. How can you have faith in something that you don't even believe? Thank God for the second step. Said I could come to believe. But I needed a starting place, and George gave me permission to start at a very simple level, and I began there. And it says, much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make approach and effect the contact with Him. See, I didn't know you could have a conception of your own. Back in our part of the country, you go to hell for having your own. I mean, if you try to come up with your own conception, you go to hell for that. Do you see? Even today.
An old idea cast aside, a new idea takes its place. What a wonderful idea that I don't have to believe as they believe. I can have my own conception of God, however inadequate it might be. That's the starting point. Mm-hmm. And we alcoholics don't have any trouble with our own conception of anything. You let us believe in God the way we want to, then our ideas about God begins to change. So here's the first idea, old idea cast aside. That idea was I had to believe as they believed. A new idea takes its place. I don't have to believe as they believe. I can have my own conception of God. And already, my ideas about God are beginning to change.
And as soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe, understanding the totality of things, underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. We found that God does not make too hard a turn for those who seek Him. To us, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who honestly seek. He is open, we believe, to all men. See, it's not in the finding. I thought you had to find God. I said, George, do I got to find God? And he said, Joe, God's not lost. You know, he said, it's just like the book said, it's in the seeking. If you will seek God in your life, God will disclose Himself to you. It's in the seeking, not in the finding. And boy, I didn't know that, and that was great news for me. Just to seek, to wonder, to think, to wish, to hope. And He begins to disclose Himself to me.
Another old idea cast aside. I was taught as a kid growing up that the way to God is a very straight, very narrow passage. If you fall off on either side of it, you're going to go to hell just sure as anything. The book said that isn't necessarily true. We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek Him. To us, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men. I was taught it was a very narrow path, and if you didn't follow that path, there's no way you're going to find God. And it was a very exclusive thing. If you didn't do and say as they did, then the opportunity wasn't there. An old idea cast aside, a new idea takes its place. My belief and my thoughts about God are continuing to change. Let's go to page 47. When therefore we speak to you of God, We mean your own conception of God. This applies to other spirit expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice,
old ideas,
you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this is all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to effect our first conscious relation with God as we understood Him. Afterward, we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. But that was growth. But if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere. So we used our own conception, however limited it was.
We needed to ask ourselves, now that we get our conception, once we get our conception, we need to ask ourselves a one short question. Do I now believe?
The agnostic has always believed.
Or am I willing to believe?
The atheist can become willing to believe.
But there is a power greater than myself. As soon as the man say he does believe,
agnostic,
or is willing to believe,
atheist,
we emphatically show him that he is on his way. He's on his way to a spiritual life as soon as he can believe or become willing to believe. We get to the starting point of our conception, and then we begin to make sure that we believe and we're on our way to a spiritual life. Okay. This has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderful, effective spiritual structure can be built. Believing is the cornerstone. And we laid the foundation of willingness. Step one was the foundation. Step two is the cornerstone. Believing is the cornerstone. He's given us a step-by-step approach of what we're building, a structure, the spiritual structure we're building.
Upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Asterisk, bottom of the page. Please be sure to read Appendix 2 on spiritual experience. The wonderfully effective spiritual structure that we're building is the spiritual experience or the spiritual awakening. Step 1 was the foundation of it. Step 2 is the cornerstone of it. Later on, we'll put more stones in place as we begin to build the spiritual experience, the spiritual awakening, the wonderfully effective spiritual structure. So we're already on the way. Now that was great news for us, for we'd assume we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith which seemed difficult to believe. Mm-hmm. Now right here he separates the two words, mm-hmm, faith and belief. And one of my great problems always was, especially as the kid in church, the minister always said, son, all you got to do is have faith and everything will be okay. Well, faith implies knowledge. Faith implies surety. Faith is after-the-fact information. I never had faith that God would work in my life because I never had tried to have God work in my life. Belief is up-front information. Belief is before the fact information. Belief can be nothing more than just suspicion. Let me give you an example. Let's say I moved into Boca Raton. And about 6 months after I move into this area, I've got a problem with my automobile. It just won't run worth a damn. Now, I don't know a good mechanic anywhere in this area. But you've been here for years. And I'm pretty sure you'll probably know somebody, a good mechanic somewhere. So I come to you and I say, look, I've got a problem with my car. I can't get it to run right, and I don't know anybody to work on it. Can you recommend a good mechanic? And you say, why, sure. Take your car over there to Tomer. And Tomer will do you a good job, and he'll charge you a reasonable price. Well, now, I don't know whether that's true or not. The best I can do based upon that information is if I believe you strong enough, I'll take my car to Tomer. And sure enough, he does a good job. He charges me a reasonable price. When I leave there, I know that he will do that. When I first went there, I believed he would do it based on what you told me. Now, 6 months from now, I have trouble with my car again. Well, I don't ask you or anybody else where to take it. I take it right back to Tomer. Only this time, I take it back on faith. You can't start with faith. You can only start with belief. And that's one of the greatest things that I learned in trying to find this power greater than myself, is I don't have to have faith. The only thing I have to have is belief. And I've always believed that there is a power greater than myself. Now, later on, I'm going to take a bunch of action. And when I take that action, I'm going to get results, and then I'm going to have faith. But the best I can do in the beginning is simply to have belief.
If you can't find a power greater than yourself, my sponsor said, at least find one other than yourself. I can do that.
So if I know I need the power, and I know that the beginning of the finding of the power is just to believe, then the next thing I'm going to need to know is what procedures am I going to follow to find that power? Let's go over to page 51, Joe.
51. That first paragraph. So this world of ours has made more material progress in the last century than all the millenniums which went before. Almost everyone knows the reasons. Students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of men in those days was equal to the best of today. Yet in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. And I used to wonder a lot, I wonder why we have cell phones and televisions and cars and airplane travel and those people 100 years ago or 500 years ago didn't. We just must be smarter than they are. Well, my book says that the intellect of men in those days was equal to the best of today. They had the same intellect, meaning the capacity to learn. They had the capacity to learn just then as we do now. But what happened? He said, yet in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry, research, and invention was almost unknown. In the realm of material, men's minds were fettered by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas.
Old ideas.
See, they were stuck there 500 years ago because of superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. In fact, we had that going on in America about 225 years ago. People came here for the purpose of religious expression and freedom. That was the reason they came. And they settled up in the northeast corner of the United States. And as long as those people would believe pretty much the way other people did, they were okay. But if you had any ideas that was contrary to those people's ideas, you know what they did for us? They burned you at the stake for being a witch. So if you had any ideas that were contrary to the group conscience of that area, you dang sure didn't express them because you didn't want to die as a witch. So superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas would stick you there. And as I sat here today, I've only got one problem, and that would be superstition, tradition, and fixed ideas. See, I need an open mind more today than I've ever needed an open mind. Because I know that God will constantly disclose himself to me and to us. And if I shut my mind off and say, this is all that there is to it, there is no more, then you know what? There will be no more for me. I need to keep my mind open, the channel open, so God can continually disclose himself to me.
Some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought a round earth was preposterous. I think Columbus is one of the greatest examples that we know of what you can do on belief and change from belief into faith. Joe, you want to talk about Columbus a while?
He was an alcoholic, wasn't he, Joe?
Yeah, he was a real alcoholic. He made some drunk statements. You know, he said, I believe you can get east by sailing west. Now, you know that's a drunk statement.
When he left, he didn't know where he was going.
When he got there, he didn't know where he was.
And when he got back, he didn't even know where he'd been.
That's alcoholic, isn't it?
What really made him an alcoholic? A woman financed the whole trip.
She did that twice.
But they say he died in jail. But he changed the world. Listen, one man. It shows the power of believing. One man's power of believing. One man believed the world was round. He's the only person on earth that believed this. Everybody else believed the earth was flat. They believed something that wasn't true. Their lives were limited. Where they lived was limited. The rest of the world they couldn't even use because they believed something that wasn't true. They limited themselves. Columbus come along and he said, I believe it's round. And they said, oh man, this guy's crazy. Don't believe this guy. But he believed this because he had been studying the galaxies and the stars, and he began to come up with some ideas. But that didn't do no good just to believe that. He finally made a decision to see if his belief was correct. And then after he made this decision, then he had to take some actions to carry out his decision. So he believed, first he believed the world was round. He made a decision to go find out. Then he had to do all the work. He had to get the ships and get somebody to finance all this and set sail. And he sailed and sailed until he hit land. And when he came back, he had faith. He knew that the world was round. When he left, he disbelieved that it was round. So this is the formula in which we change anything. It's the basic principles. And the 12 steps are not new. You know, Columbus didn't know. He left on belief, which is suspicious. It's kind of weak. China always just talk about. I thought he did too. He hired us. I believe he did somehow or another hire a special sailor and put him up to his lead ship at night. He didn't tell the rest of the crew about this guy. And he whispered in his ear and told him, he said, I believe the world is round. And I don't believe we're going to sail off the edge, but if you see the edge of this damn thing, you holler. But, so he had no faith. He just left on belief. He came back on faith. And everybody since then, even yet today, our airplanes that travel the ocean today, you know, they're going on Columbus's theory. They found his path. Because he the one blazed the trail by believing it and by crossing the ocean the first time. And look how many times people have crossed it on faith since then. So it is the beginning of anything that we do. And that's step two. All we have to do is believe to get started. We don't have to have faith. But we will make the decision, and we see the other steps will lay out the same plan. The third step will be the decision. Decision is followed by the program of action, 4 through 9. And then after we do that, we get the results. And once we get the results, then we no longer believe, we know. 12 steps says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we know. And then those of us who know can help the next person come to believe. A simple little formula in which we can do any, apply, these principles work on everything that we do. You know, I remember the first time I drove a car. The only way I got in that car is I believed I could drive. But what I believed was wrong. And I tried, my beliefs was wrong, and I started taking the wrong actions, and I had to learn to correct that. And finally I learned how to drive in the car, but that belief got me in the car. And when I got and once I drove the car, now I know. Now when I get in the car today, I get in there on what I know, not what I believed. And I have a unique thing in my life. I'm real keen about watching these things. And I have a problem in what I know. My wife wants me to drive like she knows. I can't drive like she knows. I have to drive like I know. And we have different conceptions of driving. And she'll get in the car and we'll go somewhere and she'll say things like, why did you go this way? And this dawns on me, well, this is my way. You go your way, and I go my way. We have different conceptions of the best way to get there. But she's allowed to use her conceptions. I'm to use my conception.
Columbus followed a little formula.
And you'll write down these key words because they're important.
He followed a little formula that the world has always known that you have to follow if you're going to change anything.
Principles.
The first thing you have to do to change anything is to be willing to do so. Circumstances are what makes people willing. Columbus became willing to change because they were trying to find a new trade route to the East Indies. And they all of them were saying that the only way you could go is to sail to the end of the Mediterranean and then go by land. And that trip took years and years and years. And Columbus, in trying to find a new trade route, he became willing to drop those old ideas and accept some new ideas. So willingness is the first thing, the willingness to change. The second thing you have to do is to believe you can do so. Columbus said, I believe that the world is round, not flat. I believe we can get east by sailing west. But his belief didn't do him any good, because he's still standing on the shore of the ocean the day he expressed that belief. Some days, weeks, months, years later, Columbus did the third thing you have to do. He made a decision. He said, by golly, I'm going to go find out whether this thing is really round or flat, if you can really get east by sailing west. But his decision didn't do him any good either, because he's still standing on the shore of the ocean the day he expressed that decision. Some days, weeks, months, years later, he did the next thing you have to do. He began to take some action. He said, by golly, I'm going to go find out and see. And he went to the king of Portugal to get the money. And the king of Portugal, being an astute businessman, said, Columbus, there's no way I'm going to let you have this money. He said, you'll sail out there and sail right off the edge of this sucker, and I'll lose every penny of it. That's why he ended up with the Queen of Spain. Sweet talked her into the idea of giving him the money, on the basis he would bring back gold, silk, spices, and etc. She gave him the money. He took the money, and he bought three ships. He put provisions in those three ships. He put crew members in those three ships. They began to go east by sailing west, day after day after day after day after day, sailing straight west. And as Joe says, surely, surely, he put the special sailor on the bow of the lead ship at night with a lantern and said, I believe this thing is round, but if you see the edge of this damn thing, you holler so we can get stopped. After having sailed straight west for several days, he got results from his actions. He found land on the other side. Now, we know that he thought it was the East Indies. It wasn't the West Indies. It was the West Indies, not the East Indies. But he had proven to himself that the world is round. It's not flat. You won't sail off the edge of it. He came right back to Europe, went right back to the Queen of Spain. And she said, Columbus, where's the gold, silk, and spices you promised you would bring me? He said, sweetheart, I didn't find any. And he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. If you'll refinance me, I'll go back.
He said, trust me, honey, please.
Trust me, honey. This time I'll find them. She refinanced him. He got the money. He got some more ships, more provisions, and more crew members. They began to go east by sailing west with one big difference. He didn't hire the special sailor, put him on the bow of the lead ship at night, because this time he went back in faith, surety, and knowledge. The first trip he went in belief, the second trip he went in faith. Now, I'd like to sit here today and tell you that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are brand new. The world's never seen anything like them before. But if I did, I'd tell you a lie, because they're based on the same formula that Columbus and any other human being has ever used to change anything. Step one is what makes us willing to change. When we can see that what we're trying to do is no longer going to work our way, then we become willing to change through step one. Step two is we believe we can do so by turning to the power greater than human power. Step three is a decision to go after that power. But our book tells us that step three will have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous course of action. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 are all action steps. In step 12, we get the results. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. Those of us that started with belief no longer believe. Today we know. God has restored us to sanity. Now we can take our faith and our knowledge, and we can go back and we can help the next newcomer come to believe. They can decide. We can help them take their action. They'll have a spiritual awakening. They'll know, and they can go back and help the next newcomer come to believe. There's only one thing we can't do for the newcomer. We cannot make them willing. That's a job that they have to work on themselves. And how does an alcoholic become willing to change? Well, very simple. Drinking whiskey.
A lot of it.
When you drink a lot of it and you're damn near dead, then you become willing to change. And I had a guy tell me in AA one time, he said, I've been in AA 3 years. I've been working on step one. All the 3 years I've been in AA. And I said, no, you haven't. I said, you don't work on step one in AA. You work on step one out there drinking whiskey. And when you've had enough of it, that you become willing to do what we tell you to do, then we can begin to help you. A very simple formula.
We were talking about this morning, and Joe was talking about this report, and he says, if you don't accept what we are having to offer, he said, step over to the nearest bar room. Not the one across town, but the nearest one, and continue to drink. If you'll continue to drink, you'll become willing.
It also says do it more than once.
Do it more than once, yeah.
Okay, if we know we need the power, and we know the beginning of the finding of the power is just to believe or be willing to believe, if we know the procedure to follow to find the power, then we really only need to know one more thing. Where are we going to find that power? And I think we come to AA just as confused about where God is as we were ever confused about what God actually consists of. You know, as a kid growing up in church, again, I got certain ideas about God. And I knew that God was a tall, elderly gentleman. I knew He stood on a cloud up in the sky. I knew He had long, flowing white robes on, long, flowing white hair, golden halo around His head, sun rays shooting out of that halo, and Joe says a big stick in His right hand. I think the reason I got that picture of God is because I noticed every time the minister talked about God, he always pointed up there. So I knew God had to be up there somewhere. But what really confused me as a kid in church is I noticed every time the minister wanted to talk to God, he always looked down here. He pointed. Hell, no wonder we get confused as kids when we're in church. And I looked 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 and I never could find God. And the reason I couldn't find Him is I never knew where He was. I never knew where God existed until I came to page 55 in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous.
There's a little story I'll tell you real quickly about this fellow I was working with in his halfway house. And he asked me to be his sponsor. And he said, well, what do you think I need to do? I said, well, I think it'd be a good idea. First of all, you get a job. Get out of here. He said, well, easy for you to say. I don't have any car. I can't get back and forth to work. I don't have any money. I said, I'll take you back and forth until we find you a job, and I'll take you back and forth to work till you get a paycheck or two. And we did that. And one morning, see, I'm taking him to work, and he tells me a story, and I think I'm helping him all along, but he's helped me here. And he told me a little story that really helped me, and the story was about these three wise men who stole the crown of life from man and woman, took it away from them. And he said, the three of them said, now we got the crown of life, what are we going to do with it? The thing that would make us the happiest. And one of them said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take it to the highest, highest crevice in the face of the earth, and we'll hide it way up there, and they'll never be able to find it there. And the other two said, yeah, but you know how they are. They'll hunt, and they'll search, and they'll eventually find it. The second one said, I'll tell you what, we'll take it to the deepest, deepest crevice in the deepest ocean, and they'll never be able to find it there. The other two said, yeah, but you know how they are. They're cunning, they're baffling, they're powerful, they'll eventually find it. The third one said, I'll tell you what we'll do. Let's hide it within himself, and he'll never be able to find it there. And our book said, yet we've been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world. People who rose above their problems, they said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We'd seen spiritual release, but like to tell ourselves it wasn't true. Actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it's there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and the miraculous demonstrations of power in human lives are fact as old as man himself. See, we're just born with it. It's just there. We finally saw that faith in some kind of a God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. And the last analysis is only there that it may be found. And it was so with us.
You know, it seems as though every human being seems to be born with some form of knowledge lying inside themselves at a subconscious level that seems to be able to tell us how we should live and how we shouldn't live, what we should do and what we shouldn't do, how we should act and how we shouldn't act. Now, I'm pretty sure a lot of people would like to call that the conscience. I'm pretty sure a lot of people would like to call that innate intelligence. I'm pretty sure a lot of people would like to call it the soul. I don't think it really makes any difference what we call it, as long as we recognize the fact that it's there. And in my own life, it's been there as far back as I can remember. I used to be getting ready to do something, and that little voice somewhere within inside me would say, "Charlie, I don't really believe you ought to be doing this." And I wouldn't pay a bit of attention to it. I'd just go right ahead and do it. And I would get in one hell of a mess. And that same little voice would say, "See, I told you not to do that in the first place." Now, I don't know exactly what that is, but if that form of knowledge is God, and my book really says that it is, then what that means to me today is God dwells within me. He's not up there in the sky. He's not on a cloud. He's not down. He's within me. And if God dwells within me, then that means I've got my own personal God. You see, I don't worry anymore about whether he's the God of the Baptist church or not. I don't worry about whether he's the God of the Catholic church or not. I don't worry about whether he's the God of the Hebrew religion or not. If he dwells within me, he's my God. And he and I can come together in very simple, understandable terms. That's one of the greatest things I've learned in my entire lifetime. I don't have to go look for God. He's with me all the time, period. All I have to do is start responding.
Now, this next paragraph sums up this whole, all these ideas that we've been talking about. He said, "We can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, old ideas, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. It's in the seeking. It's not in the finding. If I will seek God in my life, he will disclose himself to me, because all I have to do is think honestly, search diligently within myself, and pray and ask God to be within me. And my consciousness is sure to come to me. My understanding is sure to come to me."
Based on some of the new ideas in this chapter, I was able to discard some of the old ideas. My complete relationship with God began to change. And now then, I'm ready to make a decision. Without this chapter, I could never have made the decision. So when we come back later on, we'll go into chapter 5. And we're going to find the first thing in chapter 5 is we're going to have to make a decision regarding this God thing. Thank God for chapter 4, Joe.
That's it.
Joe says that's it. Thank you all for being here. We're now ready to move in to how it works. We've looked at the problem. I can almost see Bill sitting down, reviewing what he's done up to this point, probably saying to himself, "I was able to show them the problem through the doctor's opinion and my story, Bill's story. I was able to show them the solution through chapter 2. I was able to tell them what's going to happen to them if they don't find that solution in chapter 3, more about alcoholism. And I was able to give them some new ideas through chapter 4, where they might be able then to make a decision regarding that solution or that power greater than human power. He probably says to himself, I think I've done all the preliminary work necessary. Now then, we need to tell them the program of action necessary to be able to find that power. And he sits down and he begins to write on the 5th chapter how it works, Joe.
You know, in the history of AA, it talks about how Bill came to this point in the book, in the writing of the book. And as Charlie said, he felt like he had, the first 2-4 chapters in the doc's opinion had laid the groundwork for the program. He felt like it was sufficient and that had been taken care of. And it was now getting down to the main purpose of the book, how to show the people how to find this power, how to recover. He said he felt very inadequate. He had tried to start this section of the book and never been able to get it going. It was quite a task writing this book. It's a miracle that we have this book. This book was written by 40 drunks. Can you imagine 40 drunks in your group writing a book? It took 40 drunks in my group 2 hours to sit on a Coke machine or a Pepsi machine. So it's a miracle that we have it. Bill would do the writing on these chapters. He would send them into the New York group, send a copy to the New York group, and send a copy off to Akron. And during the time of writing of the book, the groups would actually have their meetings on these chapters. Can you imagine that? And they would delete, and they'd get in and pick at it and fool with it and send it back to Bill, and then he would have to retype it again and send it back and back and forth. This is the way it was done. Ruth said she typed this 40 times before we got to the publisher. So it was a lot of hard work and a lot of frustration. And he had went through this for the first 4 chapters, and he was about worn out already. It was a lot of months' work. And now he was down to the main purpose of the book. And he knew this had to be precise, it had to be clear-cut for the reader to be able to grasp the program. He said he tried to get started and never could resist. This particular night, he asked God, he prayed. He was laying in bed with a pad and a pencil. He liked to write laying down. And this particular night, he wasn't able to get started. He had his pad and pencil, and he laid his pad down, and he asked God for the guidance and direction. He knew that this had to be clear and precise. And he picked up his pencil and he said he began to write. He started off, he had the 6 steps that they had created out of the 5 steps of the Oxford group. He knew they were inadequate. And what Bill knew about the Oxford group language was, alcoholics had a lot of problems with the Oxford group because the Oxford group was practicing first century Christianity, had a lot of religious terms and expressions that alcoholics didn't like. So Bill knew these had to be changed. He knew that he thought the steps had to be expanded. They had 5 and 6 when they put on there, you meant you lick, they had 6. And he felt like the steps had to be expanded. He didn't know how much expansions they needed. But he said the steps they had at that days contained loopholes that alcoholics would jump through. He knew he needed to close up the loopholes and change the language. So he picked up his pad and his pencil after prayer and meditation. I asked God to direct his mind. And he said he always said about this trick of night that the mind raced across the paper like it had a pencil raced across the paper like it had a mind of its own. And then inside of 20 minutes, he wrote How It Works as We Know It Today, including the 12 steps for the first time. He didn't put the numbers on them, but he went back and counted them, and he found out they were 12. Shortly after finishing the steps, John tells a story about a New Yorker, one of the guys in the program there that came by. They'd come by and visit with Bill some night, because I knew he was working on a book, and talked to him. They came by and visited with Bill, and Bill showed him the 12 steps, and the guy didn't like it. He was mad as hell. 12 steps. Golly, we had 6. Now we got 12. Now, you'd be mad, too, if you went to your meeting next week and they had 24, wouldn't you?
He said, hell, Moses only had 10. What are you doing with 12?
So hiring him got another argument. In fact, he had a brand new guy with him, and he was getting in and giving Bill hell about it, too. He didn't even know what was going on. Finally, this began and this had to be sent to the other members to be approved. And they did not like the new 12 steps. Can you imagine how we revered them today? They did not like them. Most of the reason they didn't like them, because they had sobered up at 6. You know how you'd feel, too. It's a threat to what you did. And so, this became a great discussion and a great problem for Bill, even though when he wrote How It Works. So Charlie's gone. They had some objections to the language and the way Bill wrote it. So he had to make some changes in this, and finally it was accepted after a lot of fighting, infighting too, almost fist fights. So Charlie's going to read from the original version of How It Works, like Bill wrote it that night, before they had changed it. And you might sense what they objected to or the way it was written.
And I'm going to pass that on to Joe. Joe's going to read from the original How It Works. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure by changing the tone of his voice, by pausing at various different times, he'll be able to note the differences between what it originally was and what it is today. I think through the reading of the original How It Works, we'll be able to see just exactly what Bill's intentions were. And they were quite different from what it comes out as we read How It Works out of the Big Book. Joe, would you read that original How It Works, please?
Always have to remember when we read How It Works, why we read How It Works. And back on page 45, he said that the main object of this book, which enabled me to find a power greater than myself, which would solve my problem. And this is how it works, the original manuscript. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. They don't like directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we'd be let go, absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power, and that one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. 1. Admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood Him.
Over to the care and direction of God as we understood Him. Remember that. We'll refer to it later on.
4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. We're entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly, on our knees, ask Him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make complete amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Now you may exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we've set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic.
That's the doctor's opinion. Bill's story, some of it in chapter 2 and 3.
The chapter to the agnostic.
Chapter 4.
In our personal adventures before and after.
Bill's story and those in the back of the book.
Have been designed to sell you 3 pertinent ideas. Well, Bill was a salesman, you know, trying to sell something. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life.
Step 1.
B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism.
Part of step 2.
C, that God can and will.
The rest of step 2.
Now, if you're not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away.
I think, cold, isn't it?
I think it becomes very obvious that Bill did not intend for this to be a set of suggestions. He intended for it to be a set of directions, a set of directions to the individual alcoholic on how to recover from alcoholism. Now, when the other members saw that, that's when the crap hit the fan. They said, Bill, you don't have any business giving anybody directions. You don't have the right to tell anybody what they have to do, period. I think it's also obvious through the reading of this thing that all the information necessary for steps 1 and 2 would be found in the doctor's opinion and the first 4 chapters. As the other members saw this and started insisting on making changes, then the thrust of it began to change some too. In the beginning, Bill said, well, I'm not going to change any of this. And he said, well, the rest of the members said, well, yes, you are too. And he said, no, I'm not. And they said, yes, you are. And they said, don't you remember, Bill, that in the beginning we said this was to be our book, not your book? The collective knowledge, experience, and wisdom of all 40 of us, that we would add to, delete from, and change around whatever was necessary. So it's really our book, not yours, so you need to change it. He said, I'm not going to change it. And they said, yes, you are.
No, we're not.
And he said, well, what you guys don't realize, these aren't even my words. He said, these words came after prayer and meditation. These are God's words. And they said, we don't give a damn whose words they are. It's our book, and you're going to change it. So the fight was on. And they fought, and they fought, and they fought, and they fought, and they almost destroyed not only the book project, but the entire little fellowship.
Over this.
Bill very finally, reluctantly realized he was going to have to make some changes. They didn't like these things like humbly on our knees. They didn't like these statements such as holding nothing back. They didn't like complete amends. They said, this is too much like the Oxford Group absolutes. Said, we're going to have to change that stuff. So Bill very reluctantly agreed to change. He said, okay, I'm going to compromise with you. I'm going to change these things. But he said, you're going to have to compromise with me too. And they said, well, what do you want? He said, I'm tired. I'm worn out. I fought with you all the way through the first four chapters. Now I'm really fighting with you through chapter five. He said, I'm not going to go through this anymore. If you want me to finish the book, then you give me the authority to do so. And if you don't want to give me that authority, then you finish the book. Well, they didn't want to give him that authority, but they certainly didn't want to finish the book either. So they very reluctantly agreed to that compromise. Now, what Bill knew that they didn't know is 2 pages later, he's going to put directions and you and must and all that stuff right back in the book. You know, he had it all the way up to chapter 5. They jerked it out of the reading of how it works. He turns right around and sticks it right back in, and it ruins some of the continuity of the book. But now that we know what took place, we can see what Bill actually intended for this thing to be. A set of directions to the individual alcoholic on how to recover from alcoholism. He also said as he finished it up, if you're not convinced on these 3 vital issues, you might as well reread the book up to this point or else throw it away. You've missed something. If we haven't got all that information for the 3 vital issues, then we're going to have to go back and reread or throw it away, one of the two. Very definite, Joe.
We also know that what was going on at that time in the Oxford Group, which it was at that time. At that time, you know, the Oxford Group program was intact. And the Oxford Group program, the first step in the Oxford Group program was step 3. Surrender was the first step of their program. So they kept the Oxford Group program intact. But they'd have to go out before they brought the people to the Oxford Group meeting. They would go to their homes, go to wherever they were, sit down with them, and take long talks. They would tell them about their problems with alcohol. And they would see if these people could be convinced that they were products of alcohol and their lives were unmanaged. They would talk to them at great length. That was preparation for the program. And then they'd come back on a second visit. On the second visit, they would want to find out whether this person believed in God. And once they were convinced that this guy believed he was an alcoholic and he believed in God, then they would take him to the meeting and he could make his decision and get started in the Oxford Group. So the book, the first 4 chapters, Bill says, when you read those first 2 chapters, they do what they were doing on the visits. These 4 chapters, in the doctor's opinion, will accomplish what was accomplished on the visits. Now they can start the program. We also see that beyond the expansion of the steps. The first step in the Oxford Group was step 3, in which we make our surrender to God. Bill also did a job on changing it. He did a beautiful job on putting it in language that you wouldn't offend an alcoholic. No, an alcoholic is. Alcoholic don't like surrender to nothing. He don't even like the idea of surrender. He said, make a decision to turn your will and your life over care of God. Said a little better what an alcoholic could accept. The second step in the Oxford Group was step 4 in our program, and it was called Examine Your Sins. No self-respecting alcoholic in the world would ever examine his sins. So Bill said, make a searching and fearless moral inventory. Same thing, said so much better. Step 5 in the Oxford Group was the 3rd step, and their program was our 5th step. It was called confession.
Confession and sharing.
Sharing. No alcoholic would like to confess anything. So Bill said, admit to God, yourself, and other human beings the exact nature of you. He said so much better. He had great skills. 6 and 7 were not a part of the Oxford Group program. There were some of the loopholes that Bill needed to close. And he really did. He said he thought that the program needed more power for the alcoholic than the ordinary people in the Oxford Groups. Needed some strength. Needed more changing tools. So he added the changing tools to the steps, which are 6, 7, and 10. Those are the changing tools to strengthen the steps. He took restitution. Step 8 was restitution. He made 2 steps out of that, 8 and 9. And he added 10. And the idea, when you do all these steps, you make a decision, then you do all these action steps, then you will be able to receive God's directions in your life through prayer and meditation, which is step 11. On the bottom of these steps, he added step 12, the value they had found one alcoholic working with another. So this is the expanded program of the Oxford groups from 3 to 10. And on top of those steps, he put the ideas of powerlessness over alcohol from Silkworth. And the idea of power, Carl Jung, at step 2. So the 12 steps are expanded program of the Oxford groups, coupled with the ideas of Dr. Silkworth and Dr. Carl Jung.
People come to us today, and they say, well, how do you work steps 1 and 2?
No.
There's no directions in the book on how to work them. And our answer always is, you don't. 1 and 2 are not working steps. 1 and 2 are conclusions of the mind that we draw based upon information presented to us in the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. I've always been powerless over alcohol. My life has always been unmanageable because of that. I just did not know that, nor did I know why, until I read the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. There's always been a power greater than I am that could restore me to sanity. I just did not think he would, nor did I understand the insanity that I had to be restored from until I read the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. Now that I've read the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters, I can fully, completely say to myself, you betcha I'm powerless over alcohol. My life has become unmanageable. I'm through with step 1. By reading the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters, I came to believe there was a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I'm through with step 2. And Bill recognizes that when he says, being convinced, we are now at step 3. Being convinced of those 3 pertinent ideas, I've got steps 1 and 2 behind me, and now then I'm ready to start on step 3. You see, the real fallacy in trying to get the newcomer to go to chapter 5 and do what it says, without reading the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters, now becomes apparent. Because chapter 5 starts with step 3. And you can't really make this decision unless you've taken steps 1 and 2. And you really can't do 1 and 2, take them, unless we know the information presented to us in the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. Now then, we're ready for step 3.
It says, being convinced, as Charlie said, of the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters and the ABCs, being convinced. And if we're not convinced, we need to go back and reread the book to this point so we are convinced. We were at step 3. We're not ready to take step 3. We're just at step 3. There's a little more information we're going to have to get here in the next 2 or 3 pages, because the next 2 or 3 pages, he's going to tell us how it works. He's going to tell us why it won't work. And then he's going to tell us how it really works in the next 2 or 3 pages. He said, being convinced we were at step 3, not ready to take it yet, we're just there, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him. Well, just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? Well, that's a good question, isn't it? What do they mean by me turning my will and my life over to the care of God? He said, I'm going to make a decision to turn my will, and what is my will? My will is my thinking. The main problem the alcoholic centers in his mind. We're going to let God direct our mind and our thinking and our life. And our will is our lives. I'm going to let God direct my thinking and my life. And that's what they mean by step 3. I'm getting ready to do that. I haven't done that yet.
I hear people quite often say that I've been in AA 4 or 5 years. My life's still all screwed up. I don't understand why. Because I turned it over to God when I took step 3 4 years ago. No, We don't turn anything over to God when we take step three. We make a decision to do so. The word decision itself implies there's going to have to be some further action here in order to carry that out. A good example in my own life is some years ago, Barbara and I, my wife, the lady I live with at the current time, she and I made a decision, been living with her, by the way, for 30-some-odd years, too. She and I made a decision to go to California and visit some of our relatives in Los Angeles. Well, we didn't do anything necessary to carry out that decision that year, so sure enough, we didn't get to California either that year. The next year, we made the same decision, to go to California and visit our relatives. Again, we didn't do anything to carry it out, and sure enough, we didn't get to California the second year either. Third year in a row, we made the decision to go visit them. Only this time, it was a little different. I took the car down, and I had it serviced. Barbara packed the clothes and a little food, and we got in our car, and we drove from our home to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Then we drove to Oklahoma City. Then we drove to Amarillo, Texas. Then we drove to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Then we drove to Flagstaff, Arizona. Then we drove to Barstow, California. Then we drove to San Bernardino, California. And then we drove to Los Angeles. And one day we ended up sitting in their living room visiting with our relatives. Not because we made a decision to do so, but because we took the action necessary to carry out that decision. And we're going to find as we progress through the rest of the steps that 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 are all action steps designed to carry out this decision we're making in step 3. Now, what is it we're deciding to do in step 3? We're deciding to turn our will over to the care, and that step originally said, and direction of God as we understood it. Now, what is our will? Well, our will is nothing more than our thinking apparatus. Our will is nothing more than this thing up here in our head that tells us what to do and what not to do. Our will is nothing more than our mind. Now, tying the word will together with the mind, we have a perfect example. Let's say some of us are beginning to approach the end of our lives, which many of us in here are, getting reasonably close to it. We've gathered up a few material things. We become concerned with what's going to happen to them after we pass on. If we get concerned enough, we'll go sit down with an attorney somewhere. And we'll tell that attorney what we want done with these things. I want this to go to my daughter. I want this to go to my son. I want this to go to my brother. I want this and this and this and this. Now, that attorney will take my thinking as of that day coming from my mind, write it down in legal terms on a piece of paper. I'll sign it, and maybe the attorney will sign it as a witness. We put it in the safe and go on about our business. Now, sure enough, 3, 4, 5 years later, I kick the bucket. And if my family's like all the rest of them I've noticed, they're going to call that undertaker and say, come get him, and let's get him in the ground just about as soon as we can. Used to it took 4 or 5 days. Hell, anymore, it just takes a couple days, and they do it in a hurry. They take me out to the cemetery, suspend me in a box over a hole in the ground. A few people standing around that box, and somebody says a prayer or two. I hope it'll be an AA member that does so. After the little service is over, they begin to drop me in the hole. Now, my family's like all the rest of them. They're not even going to wait till I get to the bottom of the hole. Just as soon as I start down in that hole, they all run and jump in the car, and they head for that attorney's office. And that attorney gets that piece of paper out.
Gonna flip the button.
Right now? Okay, we're going to...